It is hour number two of Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. At 1:45, where are we at in society? A home inspector is in trouble for pleasuring himself with a client's kid's stuffed animal. Gives whole new meaning to the term Tickle Me Elmo. At 1:30, two Longhorns find their way onto an NBA mock draft. In a mere minutes, it is the Shirts and Skins movie review of Reservoir Dogs. I'm Trey Elling, and sitting across from me is Mr. Pink himself, Chad Hastings.
Why do I have to be Mr. Pink? What, can we pick our colors? I don't understand. No, you can't pick your colors. Reservoir Dogs 1992, that is coming right up. We've hit the top of the hour at 1 o'clock today, and that means Mr. Spieth is about to get out on the course at the Masters. To keep you updated, the lead is at -4 already. It is still Matsuyama and Leishman that share the lead at -4. There's a little group at -3 that includes Webb Simpson. You probably know that name if you know golf, along with Paul Casey at -3. Some of the other names we will watch. We've got a couple guys in red numbers you might care about, and they are both lefties. First one is lefty, Phil Mickelson, and by the way, Phil's rocking the shades today. Oh my God, he looks great. Phil Mickelson, -1 through 2. Phil winning would be an unbelievable story, obviously, but we'll just hope he plays pretty well. Bubba Watson, also -1 through 13 holes. Spieth just teed off. He's a little bit off the fairway, I think, but I think he'll be all right there. We'll keep you up to date on Dustin Johnson, -even through 12 holes. DeChambeau, -even through 1, just getting started. Scottie Scheffler's playing with Phil, and he's +1 through 2. We'll keep you up to date on the Masters leaderboard. But it's Thursday at 1 o'clock, and outside of football season, we want to lock this in, anchor this down for you. It's our movie review Thursday. We picked all kinds of different movies. It could be one we've neither of us have seen. Maybe we both have seen it. We just want to revisit. But a lot of times we like to find one that one of us has seen and is passionate about one way or the other.
Yep.
And then the other one hasn't. And I was shocked on this one, Trey.
Occasionally, we will go neither has seen, but it needs to be a movie with a really good reputation.
Yes, exactly. If we both know, like eventually, like if we both hadn't seen The Godfather or something, we'd probably get around to that. But in this case, we were talking a few weeks ago, we reviewed Once Upon a Time in Hollywood last year.
Oh, so good.
From Tarantino. We both love that one. And we were talking, and I just mentioned Reservoir Dogs, and Trey said, well, I've never seen Reservoir Dogs. And I thought, well, wait, hold on, stop. This is what we have to do. So we are getting into a little review here. Obviously, spoiler alert, if somehow you haven't seen Reservoir Dogs and you don't want it ruined, you may want to check back with us at about 1:25.
I guess there is an ending that you could spoil.
There's a little bit you could spoil, probably, with this movie.
There is an intrigue in that last scene as to who lives.
So yeah, right, there's a little bit of little bit of mystery there. So Reservoir Dogs 1992, this is Quentin Tarantino's full-length directorial debut. I'm gonna let you start talking about it because you'd never seen it before. Give me your, what's your first overarching thought of Reservoir Dogs?
Just a great movie from the standpoint of filming guys having everyday conversations around the table, in the car, multiple people in the car, you know, the jumping back and forth on the timeline versus having everything linear. I think it all worked so well, and it does build up the intrigue, too, because you have everybody sitting around the table in the beginning, and the very next scene is two of those guys driving away from this botched crime. One of them is shot, likely not going to live by the end of the movie.
It seems serious.
You're wondering what the hell is going on. Yeah, because it goes from a conversation on what the Madonna song Like a Virgin meant to Steve Buscemi character saying that he refuses to tip, which is something that maybe we can get into in a little bit.
Great sequence there, yeah.
And then two, the Tim Roth character shot in the gut and Harvey Keitel driving him back to the safe house. It was really good from beginning to end. There, I really don't see any flaws. I was wondering about Tim Roth as just who he was cast as at the beginning, but by the end, I end up feeling like he did the best job out of anybody.
Well, I was just thinking, can you imagine reading that script as Tim Roth and knowing what you have to deal with? I went and looked at his history. He's all the way back to like the early 80s in terms of television and getting some of his start, and a famous British actor. And the condition he has to be in to pull this off. Like, there's a couple scenes where you're jumping around in the timeline where he's has not been shot.
Yep.
But, spoiler alert, 98% of this movie, the man has been shot in such a way that he is dying, and he has to play it off like he is on death's door, and he does an incredible job of it. Also, Trey, the detail in that first scene where you see Tim Roth in major trouble, for me, is the white upholstery in the car. It's almost critical to the scene.
Yeah.
If you put him in black upholstery or a different color, it's not quite as effective.
No, there's, that contrast is important.
There's something about the blood all over that car that really kicks you into, that's right after the credits roll.
Right.
And you get this badass intro and they're walking down the street and you're like, oh, this is going to be a cool, you know, kind of, this is going to be a cool shoot 'em up criminal kind of movie. And then all of a sudden he's in that back seat, blood everywhere. Roth was incredible in this movie. So it's got that crazy start to it. And I love Reservoir Dogs because even though I've seen it a few times, it's what you don't know in this movie that makes it interesting to me.
So an example of this is I'm trying to figure out who it was who snitched, who let the police know what was going on. And I initially thought it was going to be the Chris Penn character.
Mm-hmm.
When they all get back to the safe house, and the Madsen character is starting to turn a little bit more psychopath, and the Chris Penn character comes in. I'm like, this fat guy, gosh, I'm being a fattest right now, aren't I? This guy sounds like he's not being totally honest about things.
Mm-hmm.
And then very quickly, you find out, well, not very quickly, but you ultimately find out right before Madsen lights the police officer on fire who the real snitch was. And it's a guy who was a cop all along, the Tim Roth character.
Yeah, and that part of it, that turn is really interesting. And then the other element of this movie that jumped out at me is the music angle, because I'm a music snob just like you are.
Mm-hmm.
Two songs that I will never hear the same way again. Obviously Stuck in the Middle with You by Steeler's Wheel. I cannot hear the song now, covered, the original version, without thinking of Michael Madsen. The way he plays the scene, I'm getting chills just talking about it. The way he plays it is terrifying. The idea is terrifying. I'm reading that in screenings, people walked out. I read that Rick Baker, the famous makeup guy.
Yeah, makeup costume guy.
And Wes Craven, both. The famous director walked out of a movie.
Oh, come on.
And they said later that Quentin needed to take it as a compliment because it just got too real for them.
Okay, all right.
That's what they're saying.
I can buy that a little bit better. If they were upset with the amount of gore on the screen, it's like, well, you guys are being a little bit hypocritical there. But that makes a little bit more sense.
It might be my favorite usage of a song in a scene of a movie ever. Like, it's just, and it makes no sense. It makes no sense, but when you see it all played together, you can't hear the song any differently. And then the other song for me is, Hooked on a Feeling. Ooga Chaka, Ooga, Ooga, Ooga Chaka. Mm-hmm. I will never hear that song and not think about Reservoir Dogs. So the musical connection is also what makes it a big deal for me, and it's why it's my favorite Tarantino, is that introduction. You could tell the music mattered to Quentin.
Favorite usage of a severed ear?
I haven't seen a lot of Vincent Van Gogh is the year, right? I haven't seen a lot of Vincent Van Gogh biopics, so I'm going to say yes.
There was a
say yes.
Vietnam movie from the 1980s where one of the soldiers had a necklace of ears. Gosh, what was that? Was it Tour of Duty? Was it a platoon?
Awful.
Somebody on the text line can help us out there, but that's the only other example I can think of with the severed ear. And then, of course, you have the Tyson... Evander Holyfield fight from a few years back as well.
Yes,
but that's
right.
Less cinema and more live sports.
You do have that.
Yeah, the Michael Madsen character, he was terrifying. The reveal in that moment just before he lights the police officer on fire. And then them going back to Tim Roth, essentially hatching up this plan to catch these guys, doing what it is that they're trying to pull off and really bringing them the idea. And setting them up in that way, too.
Yeah, when Quentin decides to let you know stuff in this movie, I just found fascinating. It's like the key to it was, and there's something that occurs in this story that we never see.
Mm-hmm.
Another beautiful fact of this movie, and apparently it's an homage to some other movies Quentin loved. He's a complete movie freak, as people probably know.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's a movie that Kubrick did called The Killing that Quentin has admitted was kind of his homage to that movie. It's his killing is what he calls it. The Killing, if you ever want to check that one out. But the fact that there is a diamond heist, there's a shootout because of it. People get shot, people die, yet we never see that moment in the entire movie. We never see it actually happen.
You're right about that, but we do see Tim Roth getting shot, and you assume the entire time that he was shot by a cop. No, right. He's shot by the woman that they're trying to drag from her car so that they can get away from the incoming sirens. That was another one that took me by surprise.
And you had that moment of, in his crazy reaction, he kills an innocent person.
Well, and you see it on his face also, and this is where Roth really got me, where he really hooked me as to why he's probably my favorite character in this movie. You can see just the anger and disgust on his face after Harvey Keitel's character unloads on the two cops who pull up on them. You can see how disgusted he is that he just killed two police officers because, of course, Tim Roth is also a police officer, but then he ends up having to kill someone as well.
Oh, and then you mentioned Harvey Keitel. What a beast. I'd almost forgotten. I always forget he's in the movie in a way, but he's so good. Harvey Keitel as Mr. White is so good. I didn't know he was a co-producer of this, but Trey, apparently Quentin was going to make the movie on his own. Keitel got it through like two different channels. It was like a friend of a friend of a wife of a whatever got it to Keitel, and he liked it, put about $1 million or so into it, and that's how they got the casting situation in New York that got them Buscemi, Roth, and Madsen.
Mm.
So without Harvey Keitel, none of that happens. And I never realized that. So Harvey Keitel, and obviously he ends up, if you don't know Quentin movies, he ends up in Pulp Fiction and in other places, I think, in Quentin's work. But that's I'm sure Quentin
what
would...
What is he, the wolf?
He's the wolf, right, in Pulp Fiction. I'm sure Quentin would tell you how important Harvey Keitel is to the beginning of everything.
And Stephen Wright serving as the DJ, quasi-narrator.
How'd you enjoy that?
I didn't realize it until after the fact. I'm like, where do I recognize that name from? And then I went and did some research afterwards. I'm like, oh, man. What a fitting bit for Stephen Wright's IMDb, right?
Oh my God.
Goes from guy on the couch and half baked to the DJ in Reservoir Dogs.
It is the worst casting by definition for a radio DJ. Worst idea ever.
Worse than me as a radio personality.
You are like wacky FM morning DJ compared to Stephen Wright.
Thank you. That's what I'm going for.
And it was beautifully done, though. I love the way he delivers it. His voice leading into the Steelers' Wheel song, leading into Stuck in the Middle with You, it adds a weird level of comedy to that scene, and you hate yourself for being entertained by it because of what's happening, but that's what Tarantino can do to you.
Something else that I'm a sucker for, when you're playing a really good piece of music, and then that fourth wall is broken in a sense, and the director lets you know that the person in the scene is also listening to that same music, where you've got this music blaring and it's fitting perfectly as Roth is getting ready to, I think he's getting ready to go meet those guys to pull off the job. And he is digging through the bowl of change to get his wedding ring. And at some point during that scene, he flips the radio off and you can tell he's listening to the same song too.
Yep.
I love that.
Yeah, that's a good little detail. You're right. Tim Roth giving himself the pep talk at the end of that scene is fantastic. And we haven't really talked about Buscemi a lot, but Buscemi is Mr. Pink, critical to the movie. His dialogue is so great. What'd you think of the no tipping deal? I kind of thought of you when I saw that scene. I'm like, I wonder what Trey's going to think of the no tipping rant.
Look, all you need to tell that guy is, dude, they're not even making minimum wage. They make their wage based on tips. And perhaps you have a point with the McDonald's employees, but the McDonald's employees start out making more per hour and less is expected of them than when you're at a lot of restaurants, too. So stop being an a-hole and tip these people, please. And go ahead and make sure and tip 20 to 30%. Just actually tip 30 to 40% for you because you've probably stiffed so many waiters and waitresses throughout your life.
And also for those Lebowski fans that are listening out there, much like John Goodman getting after Steve Buscemi makes part of that movie, Lawrence Tierney is the guy that plays Joe.
Yeah.
Him coming to the table and going after Buscemi on it when nobody else would was priceless.
Yeah, give me a buck. All right, I'm going to give you this buck, but only because you're paying Otherwise, I would say no.
Just brilliant. It's brilliant. Mr. Pink is awesome. Madsen as Mr. Blonde is terrific. Tim Roth is great. Keitel is great. And then the whole nonlinear part of it makes this movie interesting. If you've never seen it, it is bloody. It's bloody. It's violent. And it's gun violent, whereas later on, Quentin would really get into, you know, sword violent with the Kill Bill stuff. Kill Bill Volume 1 got really sword violent because he loves kung fu movies. This one was just he loves shoot 'em up criminal thief movies. Mm-hmm. And he decided let's get pretty bloody. And they do. It's a very intense movie to watch, but I love the way it's structured. I dug watching it again. It's not one I rewatch a lot, Trey. It's not one I go to every 4 months because it's so heavy. But for something like this, I really enjoy just sitting through it again.
Well, I feel like I could go back and rewatch it tonight or this weekend and enjoy it a little bit more, too. Just because it's done in such a non-chronological manner that inevitably you're going to miss something. You're going to miss a couple somethings the first time around.
Yeah, just the setup of now, because now you know. It's almost like when you go back and watch Usual Suspects the second and third time. But you know what you know the whole thing now, and you go back and think about how Quentin was constructing the idea. And it was brilliant to me of what he's not letting you know and when he decides to let you know. And it's like, oh, that's a great way to do that.
So did Tarantino not even film the Diamond Heist? Was that not even filmed, or did he film it and decide to leave it out?
I read that he was focused on not having it in there, and he just kept fighting against the idea of, yeah, no, we're not going to have it in there. We're not going to have it in there. We're not going to have it in there. And he didn't.
Because that's my only question is how each of those guys escaped individually.
And apparently, there's another movie we might want to think about. Have you ever seen Glengarry Glen Ross?
No.
I haven't either. Apparently, there's a similarity where there's something in Glengarry Glen Ross that we never see.
Mm.
There's a key moment that we never actually witness. But I
guess it depends on the moment. I would be interested to see that part because nobody got shot. No, I'm sorry. One guy got shot and killed. One of the guys got shot and killed.
Mr. Blue.
Yeah, Mr. Blue got shot and killed.
Mr. Blue did not make it past the table, the diner.
He did not make it.
Much past that.
No, he did not make it, but everybody else made it. So how did they get away?
So tell me about just give me your thoughts on the Mexican standoff scene real quick at the end, because you've got Harvey Keitel, you've got Madsen's already gone by then. You got Keitel. You've got Chris Penn's performance. Mm-hmm. You've got Buscemi.
Tierney.
And Tierney.
And Roth has one of the guns pointed at him, too, right?
And Roth is involved, right? He's also involved in that scene. What did you think of the last little scene of the movie?
I think it was a little bit of a stretch that all four end up getting shot.
Okay. Well, Buscemi doesn't, right?
Or all three end up getting shot. Yeah, Buscemi is hiding, and he ultimately gets shot by the cops.
I love that he crawls out from under that ramp.
I was happy at first. I'm like, oh, great. Steve is the one who gets away. Like, that does make me happy because other than Roth, obviously, although Roth's kind of a bad guy also since he set all of them up for that. But I always root for Steve Buscemi. If Steve Buscemi wins the end of a movie, that's a good film in my mind.
All right. Is that your favorite scene? What's your favorite scene? Reservoir Dogs.
Let me think about that for a sec. What's your favorite scene?
Mine's stuck in the middle.
Yeah.
It is stuck in the middle. Again, terrifying. It shouldn't be because it's not normally my kind of thing, but right. I'm in awe of it every time I see it, is even as uncomfortable as it is. I got to go with that. The ear scene, the stuck in the middle with you scene with Madsen, that's my favorite.
So I will agree with that if I'm allowed to extend that scene through Tim Roth shooting him.
Okay, yeah.
And then the cop actually admitting that he knew who he was.
Yeah, that whole run, you're right.
And that they had met several months back or whatever.
This is a movie that will exhaust you to watch.
Oh, it is emotionally taxing. It's like Children of Men, in a sense.
Yep, it takes stuff from you as you're going through it. You can't just watch this movie on happenstance on a Saturday afternoon. You got to be paying attention.
So Madonna really liked the film, but ends up at some point refuting Quentin Tarantino's interpretation of Like a Virgin.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I never knew that.
She gave him a copy of her erotica album and signed it to Quentin. It's not about Richard, although substitute Richard's nickname.
Yeah,
it's not about Richard. It's about love, Madonna. Aww.
Well done. I never knew that part.
So
thank you for that.
Hearing that for the first time in the opening scene, it did make me wonder. I was like, wait a second. is he right about that? But turns out he's not.
As always with Quentin Tarantino dialogue, it always sounds like it could be true even if it's not. Much like the great dialogue in Pulp Fiction.
Right.
There's just a lot of good stuff in there when Quentin writes that kind of stuff, and it was great. I never heard the Madonna reaction. That's cool. Very cool. All right, you want to go grades first or what?
Yeah, let's go grades.
You want to throw it out or you want me to go?
Oh, you go first. I'm curious to hear, since you were the one who requested this one. I think anytime one of us requests as a movie that we really like and we want the other one to watch, you go first.
Okay, fair enough. I will go first. I gave Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a 9.0. I really enjoyed it. I'm going to go above that here. It is my favorite Tarantino movie. I'm going to go 9.4 on Reservoir Dogs. Mm. I was going to go a little higher, but then there are a couple things that feel a little, I don't know, a little dated, a little attempted to me.
The usage of the N-word?
That. Yeah, some of that stuff. I'm like, okay, not quite as, it doesn't quite live in 2021 the way I'd like it to.
But that's authentic Goomba tough guy talk.
It is, exactly. It is. No, Tarantino was trying to make an authentic movie in 92.
Some homophobic slurs in there, too, that do make us cringe in this era.
So it is, it's a really, really good movie, and it'll always be my favorite Quentin. So I'm going to go 9.4 on Reservoir Dogs. What do you think, Trey?
Oh, my gosh. I'm reading some more trivia right now.
Yeah.
How about these two bits? One, Tim Roth refused to read the script for the film and refused to try out for the film.
Sweet.
But he did insist on going out drinking with Tarantino and Harvey Keitel. And he agreed to read for them once they were all drunk.
Nice!
And then, speaking of your favorite scene, Tarantino had to fight Harvey Weinstein to keep the torture scene in the film.
Wow.
Because Weinstein was worried it would have serious negative effects on the audience. Tarantino stood his ground, and Weinstein, unlike most instances of this in his life, ultimately relented.
I also read that Madsen had a tough time getting through it, especially when the cop screams out, "I've got a little kid at home."
Ooh.
That was not in the script, and apparently it freaked Madsen out.
Whoa.
That kind of jarred him in a way that, he had a tough time getting through that scene. But yet it ends up being one of the most famous / infamous scenes anywhere, any movie, anytime.
And by the way, the entire soundtrack budget was spent on securing Stuck in the Middle with You.
Is that right?
The entire soundtrack budget. So my grade, went 9.4?
9.4.
I don't ever really feel good about this. It really plays into what
I left you a little room.
BK accuses me of always giving movies too high of grades. I'm giving it a 9.5.
There you go.
First watch through.
There we go.
This is a classic for a reason, man.
I like it.
And I don't ever not like a Tarantino movies, but sometimes I'll see a Tarantino movie and I'm like, that was okay. But this one, it hit home.
It cuts through all the mess, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's also barely over an hour and a half, too.
Hour 39.
Yeah, it's become an issue of his over time. Like, he's making these 3-hour sagas, and yeah, there's a lot of violence in them, but it's still 3 hours out of your day. And so for this to finish up at like 1:39 or something, I got to give it an extra 10th of a point for that. So that's why it finishes it at a 9.5.
I dig it, man. I like it. Again, I like it better than Pulp Fiction, and most people liked Pulp Fiction better than Reservoir Dogs. I like Reservoir Dogs better. So 1992's Reservoir Dogs, there's our movie review. If you've never seen it or you just haven't seen it in a while, go revisit. Go revisit Mr. White and Mr. Pink and Mr. Blonde. It is unbelievably good stuff, but it is very adult. Do not let your kids watch Reservoir Dogs unless you really know who your kids are. Coming up next, we'll get into an NBA mock draft with a couple Longhorns in it. Where are Jones and Brown oriented in this mock draft? We'll let you know. Plus, a former Longhorn made a return in the NBA. We'll get you that Masters leaderboard update, too. Jordan Spieth is on the course. We'll tell you what he's doing coming up on the Horn.
Shirts and skins.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.
Trey, you know those songs when if you want to clear the room with a certain person, you know you can play that song and they'll have to leave? That's what this song is for my wife. My wife hears Tracy Chapman's Fast Car and almost rips the knobs off her radio in the car to turn it off. She hates that song.
What?
I know. It's bizarre. She can't stand Tracy Chapman's voice for some reason.
Oh, wow.
I love that song. Every time I hear it, it makes me feel good. I dig Tracy. I dig the other stuff, a couple of those other hits that she had right off of that. And was it Talking About a Revolution? Was that the other one she had? Some really good stuff, but yeah, my wife can't stand it. So anyway, Fast Car.
You've heard of misophonia before?
I've heard.
It's a
yes.
It's an affliction where there's just certain sounds that are like nails on a chalkboard to a person.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of people have this one, Justine included. Listening to somebody eat food, even if they're eating with their mouth closed, it just drives you crazy.
Okay.
It's little mouth sounds for my wife, which sounds dirty, but it's less dirty when you realize it's not just things like that. It's like when the dogs are licking themselves.
Ew.
Across the living room when we're trying to watch television. She'll like throw pillows at them to get them to stop. That's how much it bothers her. Maybe that's what Tracy Chapman's voice is for your wife.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, that dog sound is that for my wife too. She'll throw stuff at our dog for the same exact reason. So Fast Car, Tracy Chapman, little podcast connection for us?
Yes. The latest episode of the podcast is with author Alex Davies. His new book is called Driven. It's about the past, present, and future of making the self-driving vehicle. It's a really interesting conversation. Highly recommend you check it out at booksonpod.com or by searching Books on Pod with Trey Elling wherever you listen to podcasts. Or if you want to make it really easy and remember one less website, just go to hornfm.com. There is a Books on Pod landing page there now as well that will take you to the website too.
Also, if you check out our page at hornfm.com, the Shirts and Skins page, yesterday after the show, we put up the interview that Trey did with Joe Coy about his new book. We got a lot of good response off of that. Joe Coy is a very popular comedian with a lot of people, and they've seen him on Netflix, and it was a really good interview, and the fact that he's opening up in the book is really cool. So check that out at hornfm.com. Also, our conversation earlier in the week with Jeff Ward is up there as well. His thoughts on Major League Baseball moving the All-Star game. Real quick, Trey, on Joe Coy. I saw a video last night of him and his son going to buy the book. Have you seen this yet?
Oh, no.
He and his son go to a bookstore to see if the book is there. And what he did was he sat down, autographed like 5 or 10 copies, and then put them back on the shelf.
That's cool.
And videoed it and said, hey, this one's in Pasadena. I'm going all over the place. Thank you guys for supporting it. So it was really a cool deal for his fans. Somebody got to walk in there and buy an autographed copy just, you know, because it was sitting there. That's pretty cool.
That's great. I love that. Yeah. Joe strikes me, just based on reading the book and speaking with him the one time, as just a really generous dude with his time. And it makes sense when you read about just how thankful he is to everybody that has helped him out throughout his life, in and out of the stand-up scene.
Yeah, that was cool. It was a good, really good interview, and he seems like a good dude. He is definitely one of those good stand-ups. I got to watch more of those on Netflix. I know he's got a few specials out on Netflix. I think I've only seen one or two of them, though. Jordan Spieth, even through one hole, just getting started at the Masters. The lead is -4. Matsuyama and Leishman are still leading the tournament. Phil Mickelson's out there at -1 through 4 holes. Bubba Watson and Dustin Johnson also at -1. We will keep you updated. All right, Trey, we had to go to basketball to find a mock draft that's got 2 Longhorns in the first round. Dadgummit, I wanted to see one person in the NFL say, come on, Joseph Osai, step on over. Come on, Sam Cosmi. But it didn't happen. So we've got to go to the NBA version of it, and I guess they'll go in June again, or maybe it gets pushed July because of the schedule. NBA mock draft. Tell me about Kai Jones and Greg Brown, what you're seeing.
Yeah, so I need to thank Brian Davis of the Statesman for tweeting Sports Illustrated's latest mock draft out. And our first Longhorn that we see at number 7, going to the Toronto Raptors, is one Kai Jones.
Wow, 7?
6'11", 220, age 20. Jones is challenging eval, and widely viewed as a high-risk, high-reward type of selection. I would actually just say high-risk type of selection. The rewards are not going to be there through that rookie contract.
Well, not if you take him at 7.
He's tracking as a top 10 pick nonetheless, according to Sports Illustrated. Man. So the Raptors do take him in that slot. And we're continuing to see Greg Brown fall further in the first rounds of these drafts. This one has him going to an interesting team, though, considering how good they are this year. How about the Phoenix Suns selecting him
That'd be good.
At 29?
Yeah.
Any way you look at it, Brown's freshman year was a disappointment as his shortcomings in the feel and preparation department were laid bare against college competition, preventing him from maximizing his elite athletic ability on meaningful, consistent levels. The expectations have to be reset here, but it certainly doesn't mean the NBA won't try and work on him.
So
that is really the NBA's mindset with a lot of these guys.
It really is. They're raw. They've got potential. We're going to draft him because there's nothing better out there to draft.
Yep.
That's kind of what they're telling you. But it would be cool if he ends up at a team like that that does feel like it's getting some things going. And that's one of the better teams in the West. They're second in the West right now, Phoenix, for people that aren't following. Yep. Devin Booker.
Utah.
Adding Chris Paul. They're right there battling Utah for that top spot. Right now they'd be in second. But that's interesting to hear for Greg Brown. Throughout the season, Trey, we watched Greg Brown hit that decline while Kai Jones had some moment of incline. And I do question, you know, Shaka Smart's ability to develop those guys because I don't think he did a good job necessarily of either one. But Kai Jones at least showed us some of those sparks as the season went on of, okay, I see some of that talent. Greg Brown just, it felt like, I don't know, maybe middle of the season on, there just were no more moments for him.
So I agree with you that we should be skeptical of Shaka Smart's ability to develop guys. The other thing that I'm wondering about is, are some of these guys that are freaks for whatever their body suggests that they should be good at, do they have lower ceilings than a lot of people seem to suggest with the whole potential idea and the talk of potential with certain guys? Because even when the NBA has gotten hold of the Mo Bambas and Jackson Hayeses of the world, they haven't turned into even regular contributors at that level. So maybe they were guys who, despite their freakish frame and athleticism for their body type, they weren't going to pan out to be as good as some were suggesting when they were 19 and 20 years old.
Yes.
And I think Kai Jones ultimately falls in that category too. I still think Greg Brown can be a really nice player at the next level. A superstar? Maybe not. But he can be a regular contributor at the next level. Kai Jones might be able to get there eventually. It's not going to be in the next 2 to 3 years, though.
My concern for Kai Jones would be similar to where it was for, like, Mo Bamba. Didn't Mo Bamba get taken top 10? Wasn't he somewhere in that range?
Yeah, by the Magic.
So, 29 for Greg Brown. I feel like he has the chance to maybe play above that potential, if that makes any sense. Kai Jones at 7? Like, good for his pocketbook? Good for where he gets drafted there. I don't know if Kai Jones could ever make a team. Who'd you say it is at 7?
Toronto.
Toronto. I don't know that he could ever make the Raptors believe they made the right choice at 7.
No.
I hope I'm wrong because I love the idea of what he could be, because he is a freaky 6'11". Is that where he's going to be?
Yep.
Yeah. He is a freaky version.
6'11", 220.
He's a freaky 6'11", man. And if he is willing to develop and work, then maybe I'm wrong. I hope I will be. But, yeah, he didn't quite feel like a 7th pick. By the way, last night, Trace, Kevin Durant returned for Brooklyn. They thrashed another opponent, and they had a brilliant way to bring him back. Coming back off the hamstring. They didn't want him to tighten up and, like, have a cool-down period where something might go wrong. So they didn't put him in until midway second quarter. Mm. Then that way they just go through the halftime break. They can keep him warm, put him right back out in the third quarter, and then shut him down before the end of the game. It's really a good move if you think about it. Instead of doing what they might normally do, which is cool him down before the half, and then you'd risk that hamstring firing back up. So he went 5 for 5, if you need him, with like 7, wow. What do you have, 15 points, 17 points, something like that. 17 points, 5 for 5 shooting. He's back. Harden's out for a little bit. But when they're all back full power, you better bring a lot of points if you're going to beat Brooklyn. They scored 139 last night like it was nothing. It was no big deal.
A couple more quick points on the mock draft, Chad. I don't know if you saw this news from the last 24 hours, but Davion Mitchell, the point guard for the national champ Baylor Bears, announced his pro intentions.
There we go.
This mock draft has him going 15 to the Celtics.
Okay.
And his smooth shooting teammate, Jared Butler, going 19 to the Hawks.
Okay. I'm hoping Mitchell goes to a team I can root for, because I'm not a Celtics guy, but I am an unabashed Jason Tatum fan, even though he's a Celtic. So if Mitchell ends up there, I'm probably going to have to root for both of them, because I dig their game. Yeah. I like watching both of them play. That'd be a cool little pick for Boston.
Yeah.
I root for guys like that. Mitchell and Butler are going to be big losses for Scott Drew.
And those are the only other Big 12 players that I'm seeing going in the first round. Terrence Shannon from Texas Tech goes 31 to the Thunder.
Other than Cunningham, I'm assuming.
Other than Cunningham
yes. won, yeah.
Right. Won one overall. You're right about that.
Who does that mock have going to if you have it pulled up? So it's Cade Cunningham and then...
It's not Suggs.
Is it that Mobley? Is it Mobley? Is that his name?
Yeah, for USC.
The USC guy. And then Evan Suggs. Mobley. Then maybe Suggs at 3 or 4.
Suggs at 3 to the Pistons. 4 is Jalen Green.
Okay.
Who plays for Liga. Oh, this is one of the top-rated kids from the class of 2020 who decided to sign that quasi-pro contract with the NBA Developmental League.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. All right.
So Jalen Suggs ends up going 4. And then Jonathan Kuminga, who was in the same boat, who signed rather than playing a year of college, he goes 5. So that decision worked out well for those guys. And you wonder if Greg Brown doesn't have a little bit of regret for not going that route as well, because perhaps he would find himself in this top 10 still.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, I looked at the schedule. Last game for the Mavs is May 16th, so that's about the time the season's going to end, and then we get to the playoffs right after that. So mid-May is when the NBA regular season will be winding down. All right, coming up at 2 o'clock, we'll switch things around a little bit and go Why Today Matters at 2, because we're going to talk to Ari Temkin at 2:30 from the Dallas Cowboys Radio Network, get some football talk in, and Big 12 Radio from SiriusXM. We'll get his thoughts on Chris Beard. Up next, though, and where are we at in society? A home inspector inspects a little bit more than he should. Oh, Lord. This is The Horn.
Shirts and Skins.
I was wondering if that was happening or not.
Could have let it slide.
Yeah, well, that's a close one. That's a close one. Jerry was a race car driver by Primus, if I'm not mistaken. Trey's going with a car and driver theme today because of the latest edition of Books on Pod.
Yes, the conversation is with Alex Davies. He is the author of Driven, which is a book all about the past, present, and future of self-driving vehicles. Find out whether we can expect nothing but self-driving cars on the roads in the next 10 to 20 years, and about the prospect of flying cars. Uber has said they want to offer flying taxis to people in the DFW area, roll out a pilot program, pun intended, I guess, sometime in the next 5 years. Hear what Alex has to say about all of that and learn the history of self-driving vehicles.
All right, we're running a little late because of the last segment, so let's go Where Are We At in Society. Here we go.
Where are we at in society today?
Where are we at in society? Our buddy Cooter may be advertising with us on this segment before too long. In the meantime, wanted to give some extra love to Lynch Plumbing. Eric Lynch is good people. He is a listener of this radio station, and he'd be happy to help you out as well. Just check him out at lynchplumbingtx.com. Chad, when you're in a pinch, just give Lynch a call. All right, so that was not rhyming.
That's not how he intended that to happen at all.
No, I am apologizing to Eric Lynch. All right, so let's get the Shirts and Skins feed back on Twitch now. There we go. We're all set.
But the feed got turned off?
You have to push buttons when you go to commercial break and when you come back. And
okay,
I think there was probably music playing over us. Yeah, you know, it's one more button to push, and sometimes it's a bunch of one more buttons.
Fair enough.
So we go to Michigan for this next story where a home inspector is in trouble for going into a residence to do his job, and he ultimately decided when he was in the baby's bedroom of this home to self-gratify with an Elmo doll, Chad.
Oh, my God. And literally an Elmo doll, or are you just saying an Elmo doll?
An actual Elmo doll.
Oh, I'm offended on multiple levels now.
Elmo was tickling him, all right.
Ugh.
Kevin Wayne Van Leuven was unaware that he was being recorded by a nursery camera when he decided to enter this home for an inspection. He sees the doll, grabs the doll off of the crib, and starts gyrating on it to the point of...
Yeah, right. I got you.
Eruption.
To the point of Big Bird.
And he has now been charged. Thankfully, he has been charged with some crimes. So he did this while the homeowners were away, but the webcam the webcam essentially turns on whenever it senses motion in the room.
Right.
So it turns on, and the parents are like, well, that's weird. Maybe he's just in here to check out the bedroom as part of his job.
Sure.
And then they actually see the footage of the camera and see him humping Elmo's face.
Dude, it's just, oh, God. These stories bother me on so many different levels, but the self-control level really bothers me. Because I'm all for that. I am all for that for any person, right? Yourself, your body, whatever. I'm not one of those people that believes it's evil or it's going to cause blindness or any of that stuff. But
you're not eating cornflakes because you think it'll tamp down your willingness to do so?
But when you cannot control that...
Right.
Anything sexual, too. I'm not just saying that. If you can't control, like, it's like, oh, no, we had to have sex on the copy machine when there was 10 people in the next room. You had to what? Like, be a human being. We're not base animals. Stop it. Just stop it. Steal the Elmo and go home and do that if you really feel like you need to. But please don't do that in somebody's house.
So what do you think a good punishment is for this guy? Because I have what the maximum penalty he could face is. He's been charged with aggravated indecent exposure and malicious destruction of property. I'll say it's malicious destruction.
For some reason, a month popped into my head. The prisons are overfilled, so I don't know if I necessarily send him to jail, but a month of something. That's what popped into my head. What is it?
If he gets fully racked up on both of these charges, the indecent exposure is up to 2 years in prison.
Wow.
And the property destruction carries a max penalty of about 3 months.
Whoa, he could get two and a half years?
So he could be going away for 27 months for this. Was it worth it?
Oh my.
Versus just cooling your jets and going to, right? I don't know, there's not Toys R Us's anymore. Whatever the current toy store is, and buying yourself an Elmo doll and having your own Elmo doll there.
So stupid.
God, versus humping some one-year-old Elmo doll in the face.
Mm, boundaries, kids. Boundaries. Got to find the boundaries. That is just terrifying. A home inspector doing that. That makes you think now.
Yeah.
Because then you got to let everybody know, hey, Sally, I'm so sorry to call about this, but remember that guy we set you up with a few months ago, that home inspector? Yeah, we found something on the webcam. You guys are going to need to double check because y'all have six kids. We just have two. But he went into one of the bedrooms and he did blank. Now you got to go check because we know we like you guys. You got more kids than we do. You may want to check out. Maybe we'll see if you have any footage of the guy.
Did you ever? Oh gosh, I guess we probably should have asked this on the AMA last Friday when you were half or three fourths of the way in the bag.
Here it is.
I don't know when you started that as a kid.
Three. No, that's not true. I don't remember. Either. I don't remember.
Right
exactly.
Around the time you tried to eat the dog food.
Don't remember exactly. I would guess like middle schoolish.
Did you ever try and get pillows or other things involved in that process? That's never been my thing.
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah. Not like throughout, in the early days. Yeah.
So you can kind of understand the deviance then. I'm just being curious as to if that changes things at all.
I can understand the idea that friction being a part of that situation is something that you're going to want to explore. You just need to explore it somebody away from their house.
Yeah.
You and exploring it with stuffed animals. I'm not on you for that. I'm not. That's not my thing, but I'm not going to get on you. Privacy of your own home, you do whatever you and Elmo are comfortable with. But you can't do it in their house. While you're working, that's the other thing. You know me, Trey. You know me about work and play. Work and not work. We have to separate those things. You're doing your job. You risked your career for that. That's dumb.
So, what was it? Did you date your sock monkey for 2 months?
No. Never a sock guy.
Was there a crease in between couch cushions that you were cozying up with for a while?
Never a sock guy. I was a pretend a pillow was a person guy.
Okay.
I've been that guy.
Now, are we going with the softer pillow?
No.
The firmer pillow?
No. Never had a preference there.
Huh.
You know, just trying to have that image. It was practice. It was practicing. Hey, one day there might be a real person laying in this bed.
One day, when I'm living by myself, I may graduate to couch cushion.
That's right. Mego couch cushion, love seat cushion. You never know. You never know what it'll be. All right. See, you can get truth even when I'm sober. I'll just tell you. All right. There's some where we at in society. Please double check those home inspectors and please be a better home inspector if you've ever thought about anything like that. All right. We'll rearrange some things coming up in the 2 o'clock hour. Ari Temkin will join us. He's got a big interview he's dealing with today, but we want to talk to him about the Cowboys. What do you do at 10 if this guy falls or if that guy falls or both? And then Big 12, he's a part of Big 12 Radio on Sirius XM. We wanted to get his thoughts on Chris Beard to Texas and Scott Drew to the jewelry store to get a championship ring. All that's coming up at 2:30, so that means up next, we'll tell you why April 8th matters. Why does today matter? Well, apparently we've got to go to art school. We'll explain coming up on The Horn.